I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in. As we near the end of the year, I was thinking about how I wish we had an update to give you on a case we've covered, because over the past couple of weeks, I've been able to delete two cases from our list of cases to cover at some point because they've been resolved. Which is a good feeling. Those families have answers now. So we will continue to wait for updates on the cases we've featured. I just noticed we went through an entire year basically without any updates or arrests in the cases we've covered, but I hope 2025 will be different and we'll see some more cases arrive at a conclusion.
Yeah, that's surprising that none of the cases that we've covered have had any, you know, real substantial updates. And it's too bad that we're not a massive podcast. I know we're still growing, and I feel like you've found some cases that deserve a lot more attention, and we're like the only one that's covered it, basically. And yeah, if we had a bigger reach, then I think some of those cases could have gotten more eyes on it and gotten more traction.
Yeah, we have covered quite a few cases, I would say, that haven't been covered much by other podcasts. And that's one of the problems, is if we had, you know, this huge reach, we would be more likely to make a difference. So we're still working on growing. We appreciate all of you who are listening each week. And those of you who tell people about our show, it always makes our day when someone says they told a friend or a coworker, whoever, about our podcast. So we appreciate that. Lastly, thank you to our listener, Lena, for suggesting today's case. All right, let's get into it. Mikiko Kasahara was 21 years old at the time of her murder in 2002. Mikiko grew up in the city of Osaka in Japan, and while little is known about her early life, we know more about her life in the year or so before her murder. Mikiko traveled to the United States in 2000, where she enrolled in Texas Lutheran University's English as a Second Language program. Enrolling in this program first prepared her for admission as a full-time student at the university. Texas Lutheran University is a private school located in Seguin, Texas, about 30 miles northeast of San Antonio and 50 or so miles from Austin. In 2002, Seguin had a population of about 25,000, with 1,300 or 1,400 students attending Texas Lutheran University. So far more residents who were not students than who were. The English as a Second Language program began in the summer of 2000 and lasted until the winter of 2001. So Mikiko spent about a year and a half in the program and then started as a full-time student in January 2002. ESL students do not earn academic credit from their classes. So when Mikiko started regular coursework in January 2002, she was considered a freshman. At the time of her murder, Mikiko had not yet declared a major, but she was excelling. By the end of her first semester, she was named on the provost list for academic excellence, maintaining a grade point average just under 3.8. Mikiko's composition professor described her as well-liked and always surrounded by friends. Her professor also said she was always kind and polite, but more reserved and shy until you got to know her. Her gentle and soft-spoken demeanor was juxtaposed with a great deal of strength and determination. Mikiko's work stood out, and she was a dedicated student. Her professor recalled one of Mikiko's last writing assignments, where she wrote about an evening spent with friends in San Antonio. They spontaneously stopped their car on the side of the road somewhere during the night to stargaze outside. That was just one example of the fond memories Mikiko shared with her friends, friends who would be with her during the final hours of her life.
So it sounds like she had plenty of friends and plenty of good friends at that. Do you know if she was in a relationship or she was actively dating or?
There's no mention of a relationship that Mikiko was in. It sounds like she was more focused on her friends and her schoolwork, not really looking for a relationship unless that was kept under wraps for some reason. But I don't see why it would. I only saw mention of her friends, not a partner. Mikiko lived alone in a ground floor unit at the Sunset Terrace Apartments, which I thought was a bit different for a college student. And when I say different, I don't mean weird. I just mean most college students have at least one roommate. It certainly helps financially to have roommates, but maybe Mikiko didn't need that financial help. I do know her mom was a doctor, or it could have been a situation where her living arrangements were set up for her when she enrolled in the ESL program.
Okay, so she lived alone, but I suppose I'm wondering, did any of her friends live in the same complex or near her, like essentially pseudo roommates, but not living in the same apartment?
I don't believe her friends lived in the same apartment complex. Because of where this case goes, I think that would have been mentioned. It seemed like they lived elsewhere, probably in other off-campus apartments or even on campus. But yeah, I don't think she lived in the same complex as her friends. And the Sunset Terrace Apartments are situated off campus. However, they're not even half a mile away from campus, certainly within walking distance. The furthest I could go back on Google was 2008 to see these apartments, and they were surrounded by fields, a wooded area, and some houses. The wooded area is now a park, but then a little farther out, there are neighborhoods. The complex comprises 36 units across two stories, and the entries to each unit are accessible from outside. In the second week of December 2002, Mikiko concluded her second semester at Texas Lutheran University. The professor I mentioned earlier shared a memory of seeing Mikiko on Thursday, December 12th. She was eagerly awaiting the upcoming release of her end-of-term grades, and the professor described her as bubbly and excited. The following day, Friday, Mikiko hosted a party at her apartment, something she often did, to celebrate the end of the semester. Many of Mikiko's friends were fellow Japanese students, and they were going home for the winter break the next day. So this party was the last time the friends would see each other for several weeks until the beginning of the spring semester. This party was sometimes referred to as a small get-together and carried on all night into the next morning, with the last guests leaving between 5 and 6 a.m. And this does feel pretty late, but I suppose if you're going to stay out that late as a college student, the end of the semester would probably be the time to do so. However, the last person to leave could be critical in this case because a few hours later, shortly after 9 a.m., Seguin Fire and EMS responded to a fire at Mikiko's apartment. A neighbor called emergency services when they saw signs of a fire coming from her unit. Question was, what could have possibly happened in that approximately 3-hour window to lead to a fire breaking out in Mikiko's home?
So did the fire department get there in time to contain the fire, or did it spread to other units?
The fire is mostly contained in Mikiko's unit. The unit above hers did receive some damage, but the others were mostly unaffected, which the firefighters chalked up to being the result of firewalls that were installed in the apartments, creating a sort of barrier between Mikiko's unit and the others. Once the fire was extinguished, they determined it started in the apartment's bedroom, where they found the most significant damage, and there was a deceased person inside that room. The remains couldn't be identified because they were charred. And initially, law enforcement said they'd have to do DNA testing if the comparison of the remains to Mikiko's dental records was not enough to make a conclusive match, since she'd been burned beyond recognition. But it wasn't long before they confirmed that it was Mikiko's body found inside her bedroom.
Were they able to determine the source?
No, that remains unknown, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But we do know that this was a clear case of arson. This was not an accidental fire or an electrical fire or anything like that.
So they were obviously confident that it was arson, but they can't exactly say what it was that started the fire.
Right. But they do know it started in her bedroom. And this fire was very destructive, certainly in terms of physical evidence. And if there were signs of forced entry, they were either destroyed by the fire, or that's something the police have withheld. Like I said before, many of Mikiko's friends who were at the party or get together left early Saturday morning. So within hours after leaving the party to return home to Japan for the winter academic break.
They could have stayed out so late, since they had that long flight the next day. They could have stayed out late just to be exhausted for the flight and just sleep the whole time, because it is a really long flight. I'm assuming they're flying into Dallas and then flying over to Tokyo or some other airport in Japan. Because I've done that flight and it's like 15 hours.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe they just wanted to be completely exhausted for that super long flight. But they were the most critical to the investigation, and now they were in a different country, creating a hurdle right from the beginning. By the time Mikiko's friends reached Japan, they received the news that their friend was believed to be dead. I could imagine learning the news was like a punch to the gut for Mikiko's friends. Who could have harmed their friend after a night of celebration? This was a frightening time for Mikiko's friends, but also all of her fellow students. But law enforcement assured them that they didn't believe they had reason to be alarmed, and that there was no evidence Mikiko's murder was carried out by a serial offender. About a month after Mikiko died, the police shared what they learned from the results of Mikiko's autopsy. Mikiko did not die as a result of the fire. She was strangled before her apartment was set on fire. The medical examiner concluded that she died of homicidal violence, including but not limited to strangulation. Mikiko sustained multiple injuries before she died. A bone was broken at the joint and another joint was fused. And I had some questions about the fused joint, because you don't hear that often with murder victims. So I wondered what kind of injury would cause that. And they haven't elaborated on this detail, but generally I found that severe trauma to a joint could cause it to fuse. So if she had a broken bone in her larynx, presumably from strangulation, I don't think it's a stretch to associate the fused joint with that as well. Additionally, there was another injury that is still a mystery to the forensic experts who reviewed Mikiko's case. There was a severe injury with extensive hemorrhaging within Mikiko's pelvis. This injury and its exact nature remain a mystery because it was obscured by the postmortem thermal burns. The significant hemorrhaging would indicate this occurred before death, but other than that, we just know there was some major force exerted by the offender to that area. And I think because of its location, it's not often we talk about pelvic injuries and the homicide cases we cover. It makes you wonder if this injury could have been during an act of sexual violence. And the authorities reported that Mikiko was sexually tortured. They indicated she sustained other injuries outside of what we discussed, but they did not elaborate on those injuries. As we've discussed in other cases, strangulation is one of the most common methods of killing in sexually motivated homicides. With the amount of hemorrhaging that was present, that sounds like a significant amount of force was used, so we'll never know with certainty what exactly caused that injury and if it was sexually related, unless the person who caused it comes forward. The police also learned through the toxicology report that there were no traces of alcohol or drugs in Mikiko's system. She didn't drink or use drugs in general, and that was not the type of party this was. And tying this back to the forced entry possibility or how the killer got inside her home, one possibility is that she hadn't yet locked the door after the last person left. Or she did, and the killer knocked on her door so quickly after that she assumed it was someone from the party who forgot something, or it was someone who attended the party and lingered after the others left. So several possibilities here.
I'm assuming you're going to get into it, but were the friends questioned when they got back? And I guess how long were they gone before they could even question them?
So they were gone for the entirety of the winter academic break, so about 4 weeks. And when they returned, they were questioned. The police thought they would hold really significant information. They were eager to question Mikiko's friends. These friends seem like very vital people in this case, but the police said not much was gleaned through their interviews. It seemed that Mikiko's friends couldn't shed much light on what could have happened to her. And as is usually the case, no one anticipated Mikiko's murder. So it doesn't sound like there were any concerning or odd interactions between Mikiko and another partygoer that night. The case went quiet for a couple of years. Then Maureen Watson, the detective leading the investigation, spoke with the media, indicating that they had 5 binders of evidence, witness statements, and assessments from multiple federal agencies that got involved in the investigation. Publicly, it was very quiet, but there was clearly a lot going on in this investigation behind the scenes. Watson was dedicated to the case, and although Mikiko's family said they forgave the murderer and only asked for an apology and explanation, that fueled Watson's drive to solve the case even more. At that time, the Seguin police chief said he believed Mikiko was killed by a man, but stopped short of referring to it as a crime of passion. I'm not sure how they knew he was stopping short of calling it that, but I tend to think of crimes of passion occurring between two people who have an existing relationship, whether it be current or former romantic relationship, or even just a friendship. By all accounts, Mikiko, like I said before, was not in a relationship at that time. So the term crime of passion could, in this context, mean someone very close to her, but I suppose you could have that with a stranger too. It's just not as common.
Yeah, I always kind of interpreted it in both senses. Like, on one hand, you have crime of passion with an existing relationship, and on the other, it could be an interaction that two strangers have and one of them feels wronged, right? And then they act in a violent way and that it turns into a crime of passion at that point, right?
Exactly, yeah. Basically, just any crime that occurs in the heat of the moment. It's not premeditated. But in this case, I don't know what information they would have to say it wasn't premeditated. It actually seems to me to be a little more premeditated, especially if the killer were not someone from the party. I would think this person was then watching her apartment, waiting for the party to end. Something I would love to know is who was at this party? Because we're assuming this is a male offender, like the police chief said. So we don't know the genders of her friends at this get together. They haven't been named at all. There's like zero information out there about them. So I was thinking, well, if they were all of her friends were women, then it almost certainly wasn't someone from this party, but it could have been a mix. So that's a factor here.
Yeah, it'd be helpful to know if we knew exactly who was in the group, but for some reason, I was just picturing a mix of men and women.
Yeah, so was I. And I didn't really think about it until just now that I was just assuming that, but that may not have been the case. These people are completely anonymous, which is fine, but it would be nice to know at least kind of the makeup of this group. The case went quiet again for a while, and then at the 10-year mark, the former Guadalupe County fire marshal said they'd been reviewing the fire aspect of Mikiko's murder, telling the Seguin Gazette, quote, "I've looked at the file and continue to look at the file from the aspect of the fire, what caused it, and the timeline related to the fire. We have been able to use information from the testing conducted by ATF to establish a more solid timeline of the fire, but only in terms of the growth and spread of the fire, not as to when exactly it was ignited," end quote. It's inconclusive whether an accelerant was used. Accelerant-trained sniffer canines were brought in to sniff out accelerants after the incident, and they made several hits, but they couldn't determine if the hits were from chemicals in the carpet, wood stains, or something actually used to accelerate the fire. The sections of her apartment the dogs hit on were sent for testing, but they didn't share the results publicly. And I wish we had a clear answer to this, because I had been thinking if the perpetrator used an accelerant, that could point to premeditation. Like, they came to her apartment prepared to do this, but not necessarily. They could have used something already in her home to accelerate the fire. And that's part of what makes it difficult to determine if the killer used an accelerant. At the 10-year mark, Watson said they were reasonably confident that Mikiko's killer knew her in some way. They had a connection to her in some way, which is rather broad, but she also said they felt very confident that the offender was not one of Mikiko's friends from Japan, and most of her friends were fellow Japanese students. Some of you listening, and Sean, you may have been thinking it could have been someone from the party. I think that's a clear theory here. However, knowing that the police don't think it was a Japanese student, and also knowing many, if not all, of the people at the party were Japanese, this most likely was not someone from the party.
So it's been confirmed that this little party get together, whatever you want to call it, was all consisted of her Japanese friends. There are no people at the party who weren't Japanese.
That's how it tends to be described. Yes. And they're saying this person had a connection to her in some way. I don't think they would use that phrasing if they thought this was a close friend of Mikiko's, whether Japanese or not. I don't think they would say they had a connection to her in some way. That implies that maybe it's a secondary connection, someone who knew her from school or a neighbor, not necessarily someone in her inner circle.
Yeah, my mind went to either someone from one of her classes or one of her neighbors.
Yeah, and those two possibilities make the most sense, because she was a student. She didn't have a job, from what I read. So most of her interactions with people are going to be at school and her neighbors, or possibly even if she's just out somewhere. But I'm sure a lot of the people she would meet, if she's out somewhere, would be other students, other people her age, right? So I think those two categories make the most sense here. Plus, from what the police have shared, the investigators didn't learn much after interviewing Mikiko's friends from the party. If someone from the party killed her, you'd think over the course of the night, there may have been signs that something was off. It's not guaranteed, so the absence of that isn't proof that the person wasn't at the party, but it is significant. Because my first thought when they said they didn't learn much from her friends from the party was that either they didn't know anything and that's why they didn't learn much, or they were covering for someone else. But I suppose there would be a third scenario where one, a singular person from that party was responsible and the others weren't aware. The police clearly have information that leads them in this direction, that Mikiko's killer was not someone who attended the party. Watson went on to say that as the investigators continued to sort through the information and evidence, they had various persons of interest, but one individual continually piqued their interest, and they had been unable to rule that person out. Detective Diaz, who took over the case after Watson moved up, told the Seguin Gazette that they had interviewed that person of interest several times and were hoping to conduct another interview with him. Watson pointed out that the detectives and district attorney needed to be absolutely sure, since you only have one shot at a trial. They couldn't risk trying someone and having them acquitted because there wasn't quite enough evidence. And this is what they are faced with in many of the cases we feature, feeling like they have the right person, but not being able to prove they were responsible beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a frustrating position to be in. Of course, we've covered some cases where they don't seem to have a clue who is responsible, but there are quite a few that come to mind where it's a situation like this. And they have not named this person of interest or explained how this person was connected to Mikiko. I don't know if I've ever seen more heartfelt statements from detectives working a case. You can tell that Watson and Diaz care about solving Mikiko's case and are haunted by the thought of it remaining unsolved. Watson talked about how wonderful Mikiko's parents are, even saying she feels like she's part of their family. At one point, when Watson met with Mikiko's mom, she broke down. They were both in tears, and Watson was apologizing profusely for not having answers yet. And Mikiko's mom assured her that she knew she had done her best and that she had to let it go. I'm sure Watson will never be able to let it go until it's solved, but she is retired now, and hopefully those words have helped her get through it, knowing she didn't solve the case. Also, Mikiko's mom gave Diaz a trinket as a good luck charm that he keeps in his home. He told the Seguin Gazette, quote, "No matter what, we can put some of the best experts on this, and I'm still going to need a little bit of luck," end quote.
I'm sure they've been pretty airtight about everything surrounding this of interest, but do we know anything that they might have, any sort of evidence that they think they have or that they know will work? They just need to build it a little more. Do we know anything like that?
Well, they had one piece of evidence that we haven't discussed yet. I don't know if this evidence can be tied directly to the person of interest, if at all, but we will get into that detail here in a moment. During this media coverage, they stated they were still looking for any leads or clues from someone who may have seen Mikiko that morning or remembers anything odd about that morning. If Mikiko's killer were a student, or even if they weren't, they may have lived with someone else, a roommate. Could there be someone who remembers their roommate being gone in the early morning hours that day and showing up around 9 a.m.?
Yeah, and that would have been extremely bizarre because it was the first day of a winter break. You'd assume everyone's either already gone or they're sleeping in.
Right. And the already gone piece does present a problem, though, because it could have been, even if this person had a roommate, that roommate could have already headed home if they weren't from the area. So kind of presents a challenge. But yes, it would be a very odd time frame for someone to be gone on a Saturday, right at the beginning of this academic break, without a clear reason. If someone did see him, the killer is presumed to be male, like we talked about. Did he look disheveled? Mikiko could have struggled with her killer and caused visible injuries, or the person could have even sustained burn injuries. Probably nothing significant, but possibly some minor burns.
Yeah, and they also very likely smelled like the accelerant that they used.
Yeah, I feel like most accelerants have a strong smell, assuming they used one. Of course, we don't know with 100% certainty, but yeah, that's just one more detail that could have made this person stand out to their roommate, to their whoever they lived with. But the worst case scenario here is that this person returned to an empty home or a sleeping roommate and no one witnessed their behavior directly after the incident. At the 10-year mark, the police said they were not sure if everyone who lived at the Sunset Terrace Apartments at that time had been interviewed after Mikiko's murder, so they were very much interested in speaking with anyone who was missed during the initial investigation. Some neighbors willingly underwent polygraph exams at the time of Mikiko's murder, while others were asked to participate and declined. They also said that, based on the initial investigation, some people were afraid to speak out at that time, but they hoped that 10 years later, those fears had dissipated. I'm not sure if they're referring to other people who lived in the complex being afraid or people who were friends with Mikiko, but it all alludes to people having significant information and being fearful to bring it forward, which should be something that lessens over time. Detective Diaz shared that in the years that followed Mikiko's murder, they were able to recreate the crime scene and process a burned laptop from Mikiko's home for information. They did not share if the device belonged to Mikiko, but I would presume so, because if it didn't, then it would seem it had to belong to the killer, and this case would probably be solved by this point. Diaz said troves of Asian female pornography were accessed on this laptop around the time Mikiko was believed to be murdered. And because we don't know exactly what time she was killed, we don't know if this was accessed before, during, and or after the act. The police said this information, combined with other points we've discussed, led them to believe the killer may have had a sexual preference or even a fetish for Asian women, and that the motive behind Mikiko's murder may have been sexual in nature. That was a theory they explored, and to my knowledge, they haven't ruled out. Unfortunately, they were unable to garner any physical evidence from the laptop due to its condition after the fire, just like every other potential piece of evidence in this case.
So were the detectives able to figure out if this was an isolated incident, or it's not incident, if this was an isolated activity? Basically, what I'm asking is, what was this the only night that the pornography was watched, so it tells them that it was someone other than Mikiko watching it, right?
That's what I'm deducing, because otherwise I don't think they would bring this up. I think it would be odd for them to bring this up if this were normal activity on her laptop. I mean, maybe they still would because of the timing of it, the timing in which it was accessed, but I was deducing that this was not something regularly accessed, and that coupled with the timing and the fact that this crime already seemed sexually motivated, potentially, bringing all that together, I think that's why they shared this information, because it was unique.
Right, and they think it was the killer who accessed this on her computer.
Exactly. Yeah. And that activity feels so key, because if they could access the computer history of persons of interest they have and they found similar activity, it doesn't prove that person is the killer, but it is kind of specific, and it could be an important piece of information if they already had some evidence pointing to that individual. But I don't know if in 2002 the police would have been thinking of this, or if they'd even have probable cause, more importantly, to be able to access that kind of data from people they had their eye on. Thinking about the different theories here, it starts with, was Mikiko's killer someone she knew who attended the party, or someone who was connected to Mikiko in some way, as the police suggested, but was not necessarily in her inner circle? In regard to the second possibility, like you mentioned, I think a neighbor or fellow student makes the most sense. People who regularly saw Mikiko and could have developed an obsession with her. I will say the timing is strange. If Mikiko's killer lived in her apartment complex, they likely had been watching her home to carry this out once everyone was gone. But why pick the night when she has friends over? How could they know the last person who left was the last person to leave?
Maybe this person knew that Mikiko and her friends were going to go to Japan the next day. And, you know, the police would have had a really hard time contacting her friends, since they would have, you know, presumably been on the plane at that point, or they would have landed in Japan and would have been very hard to get in contact with for 4 weeks.
Yeah. And then by the time they come back 4 weeks later, if they saw anything significant, their memory would be a little bit faded by then. Especially if it were a small detail, 4 weeks later, that probably isn't going to stick in their mind. But that would require this person to have some knowledge, right, about Mikiko and her friends. Or they could have just been making that assumption if they were familiar with the academic break.
If this was a classmate, if they would have just spoken, just have small talk in class, and Mikiko mentioned, yeah, my friends and I are all going to Japan to go see our family on this date, then they would have that knowledge instantly.
Yeah, and if it were a neighbor, on the other hand, they could have noticed that for prior breaks, Mikiko left for an extended period. They also, I'm again, just thinking of the timing here, they also could have been thinking that would be their last chance, as sick as it is, for several weeks to be able to do this. And I like the neighbor theory because that person would have access and the ability to watch Mikiko and learn her patterns more easily or conveniently than someone who didn't live in the complex. I noticed when I was looking at the street view of the Sunset Terrace apartment complex that it had a sort of courtyard. So there were units that faced each other. We don't know if Mikiko lived in a unit that faced away toward the parking lot, or if she lived in one of these apartments that directly faced other units. If she lived in one of those that faced others, that would make the people who lived across from her interesting, because they'd be in the unique position of being able to watch her unit without leaving their home. They could have watched that last person leave and witnessed the lights in her home begin to shut off. And that could have been what tipped them off to know the last person who left was the last party goer.
Yeah. Or it could have just been her next door neighbors who could have heard when the last guest was there.
When it got quiet.
When Alaska's left, rather.
Yeah, but do you think they'd set her apartment on fire knowing that they shared walls with her?
I mean, didn't you mention that the apartment complex had some built-in fire-suppressing walls or fire prevention walls or whatever the term you used?
Yes, but I don't know if they would have known that or not. I mean, maybe they did and they weren't too worried about it, but the only unit that received damage was the one above hers.
I don't know. Maybe they called it in because they knew that the fire had taken care of whatever already and they didn't want to run the risk of the fire spreading to their apartment. So they called it in.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know which neighbor first spotted the fire. We don't have that information. And I'd also just love to know who that person of interest is. I have a feeling it's someone from this complex, but yeah, they haven't revealed who it is that they've set their sights on. Also, as the police said, I think the search for Asian female porn could point to someone having a fetish or obsession that led to this, which makes more sense for an outsider than one of Mikiko's friends, in my opinion. On the other hand, someone from the party would have already been in Mikiko's apartment, or if they left and came back, she likely would have let them in. Whereas it's hard to imagine her opening the door to someone she didn't know or didn't know very well, so they'd have to force their way in or catch her off guard. It would be interesting to know if anyone, especially any of the men who lived at the Sunset Terrace apartments at the time of Mikiko's murder, were ever arrested after the fact for something like sexual assault, rape, or some other violent crime, because it is hard to imagine this being an isolated incident, but it is possible. It's definitely possible that this was something that happened once and never again, that can happen. And I think with most of the cases we've covered, that probably is the case. And that's part of what makes it so hard to solve. But if there were a neighbor who went on to have a criminal record, I think that would be great information to have. And that's something I presume the police have looked into. I believe the police probably have their person, whether it's the person of interest they set their sights on or someone else they interviewed. I think they have that person on a list because of the belief that this person had to be connected to Mihiko in some way. And that's a limited number of people. And we can hope that maybe they'd be able to retest physical evidence from the scene with the latest technology. It's probably not likely that they would glean anything from that because of the fire, but you never know. So I just think with this case, it has seemed very quiet at times, but then when they do speak, they have a lot to say. And it seems like there's a lot going on behind the scenes. So I really hope that this is one where there's more going on than we realize. Mihiko's mom still visits the area, and each time she learns there's no new information in her case. The partygoers, as I said before, have remained unnamed, but if somehow, I don't think this is that likely, but if we somehow reach one of them, I'd love to talk if they're open to it, to learn more about this party and just get more context around that night. So on the off chance we do reach one of Mihiko's friends from that night and they want to talk, you can email us at keyofthecase@gmail.com. If you have information related to the murder of Mihiko Kasahara, you can submit information through the Texas Rangers Cold Case website or call 1-800-346-3243 to provide your tip. That is all for now, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.